Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Case is on Hold, the JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld. I'm doing the intro just out of force of habit. It's August. This is episode 63. If you're listening the day we drop, it's August 6th for our August 7th issue of JBJS. As always, we are presenting the latest and greatest in the field of academic orthopedics. Clinically relevant research to enhance your practice and improve patient care. It doesn't get better than that, am I right? Per the usual, I am Andrew Schoenfeld, the deputy editor for Methods at the Journal, and I have with me, as always, my partner in crime.
Antonia Chen, deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, still the best subspecialty there is. I just had to throw that in
there. There you go. That's fine. I don't argue with you. For our regular listeners, you are aware, but for those who may be new, what we are presenting here are our own takes and impressions of the research that was published in this issue of the journal. Sometimes the takes are intentionally hot. We need to be controversial. More controversy gets more likes, you know what I mean? You get more hits if you're creating exciting takes as opposed to being like, this was great.
Right. No one clicks if it's boring, right? So
right, no. I mean, it goes without saying, all of these have been accepted and published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. It's gone through a rigorous peer review process. So take everything for what it's worth. It's critiques in context. And I think we're going to have some very interesting insights and maybe even some controversies. We'll see what Dr. Chen thinks. But please keep in mind that the opinions you hear are our own and not those of the editor-in-chief. Other deputy editors, members of the editorial boards of this or the other JBJS journals, the board of trustees, the good folks over at Pickering Street in Needham, etc. And Dr. Chen and I are solely responsible for the takes and input that you hear on this podcast today. How's that for a disclaimer? This episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. You can get your lifelong educational needs addressed by working with the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery on its educational offerings. You don't, you know, it's great to go to meetings to catch up with people and meet others in person. But if you can't do that, you need to go no further than JBJS CME. So definitely do check it out if you haven't had the chance already. And if you have, you know, continue using it. That's about all we have for the, the preamble. We'll get into the actual substance here. First, we have top of the pile. What are the non-research related articles that are here to inform and entertain, as it were? We have large language models in orthopedics, definitions, usage, and limitations. This is a very hot topic, and it's by Yao and colleagues. We have sex and gender in orthopedic research. How do we continue to move the needle? An extension of the JBJS symposium on sex and gender in orthopedic research that will have articles appearing, I think, in the next several issues in small bursts, as it were. This was by Templeton. And then we have inclusion of sex and gender to improve the state of the science of women's health by Temkin, followed by what's important, non-neural networks, building a personal and professional network in residency by Richardson and colleagues. A proposed conceptual framework for patient selection for knee arthroplasty by Gumrawi. And then AOA Critical Issues, Promoting Leadership Development Among Orthopedic Faculty, a concept that's near and dear to all of our hearts, and this is by Berger. We'll now head into the headlines. What's exciting in the news this week as far as was? My article is Incidence of and Risk Factors for Reoperation and Revision Following Total Elbow Arthroplasty with an Anatomic Convertible Prosthesis by Hill and colleagues. And there's also a commentary, so you don't have to just take my word for it. This is an article that assembles a reasonable number of patients, I'd say even a large number of patients, for the condition that's being treated. 219 total elbow arthroplasties in 206 patients performed over the course of 2001 to 2020. This is using the Latitude prosthesis from Stryker. Per the authors, I'll read here that only the Latitude system from Stryker allows the surgeon to convert between a linked and an unlinked configuration on the basis of preoperative assessment and intraoperative decision making. The Latitude prosthesis is typically implanted with preservation of the native radial head to prevent loosening or dissociation of the radial component and thereby minimize the potentially avoidable high proportion of adverse events previously reported in the literature. Now, they do note that the decision to link the components is determined on a case-by-case basis, and they express their bias toward an unlinked configuration to minimize stresses at the bone implant interface. These technical variations, they feel, influence both the short and long-term performance of the Latitude, and they state that they have not been reported on previously, and certainly not in a sample, you know, exceeding 200 patients. So their aim was to provide long-term data on the Latitude prosthesis. They do recognize it's a single high-volume center, and they specifically want to look at implant survivorship and reoperation. So they include surgeries performed by one of five fellowship-trained shoulder and elbow surgeons, again, from 2001 to 2020. And, you know, from there, it's kind of the clinical retrospective of their experience. Very interesting, nonetheless. They state, to our knowledge, it's the largest report of outcomes following total elbow arthroplasty with the Latitude prosthesis involving procedures performed at a single center using similar techniques and philosophies. So what they're articulating there is absolutely a potential for a cluster bias or an expertise bias. This is also the report with the longest mean duration of follow-up. I mean, these are all reasons why it's appearing in the annals of JBJS. They had 90 elbows, or about 41%, requiring reoperations with a mean of 19.6 months of duration between the index and the revision procedure. So they're saying that, you know, with 90 patients requiring reoperation, they postulate a risk of an assessment of the factors associated with reoperation. I think that's a reasonable recognition. They also have issues with, are going to have issues with, restricted clinical variation, potentially truncation, the expertise bias, cluster bias. It's unclear that the findings here would necessarily be translational in other centers, especially those who are less experienced in both performing the procedure and making the decisions about, you know, when to use this particular implant or some of those factors, such as linking the components. They say is determined on a case-by-case basis toward an unlinked configuration. So, you know, there's a great deal of caveat there. They do appropriately grade the level for a essentially clinical retrospective highlighting their experience over the course of 20 years. That's going to be enough when it comes to secular trends. Next thing up is the past efficacy of disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, changes in implant designs. I don't know how much that affects the Latitude system in and of itself, but certainly as the surgeons experienced over the course of 20 years, that is onto others who may be joining the practice, improvements in becoming more facile with the surgical incisions, less soft tissue disruption that accrues with experience, and also just, you know, general advancements in the field. So the experience of an individual patient who had surgery in 2001 may be dramatically different from an individual patient receiving surgery in 2020, as are the inherent risks associated with the proclivity to need a revision procedure, as well as the surgeon's intent to offer such a procedure and the patient's willingness to accept a procedure. So these are all factors that, you know, need to be considered by the erstwhile reader as they're distilling this experience through their own intentions in terms of applying it to their clinical practice. Again, you know, at the end of the day, I think the authors are very upfront in recognizing what limitations are associated and inherent to this work. I don't think they're trying to oversell, which is good. But, you know, at the same time, it's unclear that what they're presenting here will be translatable to the practice of one of our listeners, for example. In addition, I think it's quite sobering that even amongst this high volume center with very experienced surgeons, they still have a fair rate approaching almost 50% for the cohort as a whole. So that can be a cautionary tale of sorts as well. I don't have any further input. Obviously, it's not your exact area, but it is a joint replacement of sorts. So I don't know if you have any further insights or what your takes were on that.
No, I agree with you. It scares me a little bit that this center does all of this implant. They're experts in it, and they still had a pretty high reoperation rate. You know, so it is cautionary. It is good to publish, I would say, not just positive results, right? The problem is these patients who need these procedures don't have a lot of options. So, you know, this is one of the other few options, but they're upfront about it. You know, it's not industry sponsored, that sort of thing. So I think it's a good article of a cautionary tale and important to impart that on implants. I think this is where the benefits of registries will come over time, right? If you can see this for all the different implants, you know, they don't have a total elbow one, but they're going to do shoulders, they're going to do trauma, they're going to do tumor. You know, it'll be interesting to see things like this and see if different implants perform differently. And if they do, then potentially you highlight and use one more than the other. And I know that's how the other databases across the world tend to do it. And I know places like Michigan with, you know, hip and knee replacement registries, they will emphasize ones that perform better and encourage the use of those. So how this compares with other total elbow prostheses, I don't know. And maybe they all have similar LEM values because these total elbow patients just don't do great. Or this performs better, maybe this performs worse, you know, and that's something that bears out in other comparisons.
We'll now move into your headline, implant patient factors associated with acromial and scapular spine fractures after reverse shoulder arthroplasty, a study by the ASES, complications of RSA multicenter research group. This is by Moverman and colleagues and does have an infographic.
I love how we're mixing things up. We have total elbow and I have a reverse shoulder here. So to our upper extremity friend, we see you, we hear you, and we acknowledge that you replace other parts of the body. And so reverse shoulder arthroplasty has clearly exploded in popularity over time, and there have been multiple implant designs. And final implant position can result in various degrees of humeral and glenoid lateralization. And the purpose of this study was really to understand what sort of implant positioning and patient factors were associated with acromial and scapular spine fractures after reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. By having all these new implant designs, it's reduced the prevalence of dislocation, but finite element analysis studies have suggested that glenoid lateralization can increase acromial and scapular spine strain. And this increased humeral lateralization can be protective in the pathogenesis of acromial stress fractures, as active strain on the acromium during abduction is theoretically minimized by an increased deltoid moment arm. However, the conflicting data is throughout literature. So this study aimed to do this in a multi-center retrospective study manner. And what they did, they looked at 24 surgeons from 15 U.S. institutions, and they're all members of the American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons ASES group, and they pulled all their data together to come up with the results of this study. These reverse shoulder arthroplasty patients underwent surgery from June 13th to May 19th and had a minimum of 3-month follow-up. And it was 3 months after primary or revision RSA. So they included reverse total shoulder patients, which I wasn't a huge fan of, but it did include them. And I'm curious as to why it was only 3-month follow-up when the last surgical date was May 2019. So 3-year follow-up makes sense, but 3-month follow-up felt short. It's likely potentially because of the revision RSA, but it's hard to say. The mean follow-up was 19.4 plus or minus 15.8 months, so a huge standard deviation. The range was 3 months to 94 months. The study parameters and terms, data collection factors, and study design components were defined through the Delphi method, requiring 75% agreement among surgeons for consensus. And they went through 18 rounds of this, which is interesting because typically what you do is you just design a study, you collect the parameters and you put it together. You don't need a Delphi method to come up with the agreement of that per se. But they utilized this since it's most likely a committee setting that they came up with this. They defined fractures as anything that was symptomatic. So symptomatic pain or loss of motion with associated confirmatory imaging, either radiographic or a CT scan, identifying a fracture line, displacement, or evident callus at the acromium or scapular spine. Patients were excluded if they were asymptomatic, so they had asymptomatic stress responses or fractures, and those diagnosed without confirmatory radiographic evidence. Radiographic data was collected preoperatively and postoperatively and included the lateralization shoulder angle, the distalization shoulder angle, and lateral humeral offset, things I have not looked at for a long time. So the lateralization shoulder angle is a measurement of global lateral offset of the joint created by the final implant positioning. The distalization shoulder angle is a measurement of global distalization of the humerus relative to the acromion. And the lateral humeral offset is the humeral-sided lateralization created by the implant's final position. And these become relevant later because obviously we're going to look at these and see how they impact the rates of these types of fractures. Postoperative fracture patients who were not stratified by the location of the stress fracture, meaning they didn't separate them from acromion scapular spine when they did a 1-to-2 matching. In these patients, they matched 1-to-2 with the control cohort who did not have fracture. And there were two separate multivariate analyses that were performed. The first one utilizing delta LSA, which is that lateralization shoulder angle, and DSA values, which is the distalization shoulder angle, and change from pre-op to post-op. And the second multivariate analysis utilized only post-operative LSA and DSA values. Again, these are propensity score matching, and they were done by primary diagnosis, cuff tear arthropathy versus other, the presence versus absence of osteoporosis, and the presence versus absence of inflammatory arthritis. It included 6,320 patients, which is a nice large number for a total reverse shoulder arthroplasty on papers, which is really nice to pool of many centers. The overall stress fracture rate was 3.8%, and there were 180 or 2.8% acromial stress fractures and 0.9% of scapular spine stress fractures. Half of the patients had a preoperative diagnosis of rotator cuff disease, which included rotator cuff arthropathy and massive rotator cuffs. When I was undergoing residency, the standard teaching that I learned was that reverse total shoulders was for patients with glenohumeral arthritis and rotator cuff tears. So I'm kind of surprised that only 50% of them included rotator cuff arthropathy or massive rotator cuff tears, but that's my view on things there. Osteoporosis was present in 13% of the patients and 11% had inflammatory arthritis. Only 9% of the RSAs were revision procedures. So it's a small percentage of the populations, and I'm still not necessarily certain that they needed to be included. In univariate analysis, the total glenoid lateral offset was found to be significantly higher in patients diagnosed with the acromion fracture than those with no acromion fracture. And there was no difference in total glenoid lateral offset noted between patients with or without scapular spine stress fractures. So it just affected the acromial stress fracture group. Acromial stress fracture risk factors included inflammatory arthritis, a massive rotator cuff, osteoporosis, prior shoulder surgery, cuff tear arthropathy, female sex, older age, and greater total glenoid lateral offset. Revision surgery was actually associated with a lower rate of acromial stress fractures. For the scapular spine stress fractures, the risk factors included female sex, rotator cuff disease, osteoporosis, and inflammatory arthritis. The radiographic analysis of these propensity score match patients showed that a greater increase in the lateralization shoulder angle from preoperative to postoperative and a greater postoperative lateralization shoulder angle increased stress fracture risk, while increased lateral humeral offset reduced it. Distalization showed no significant association with stress fracture prevalence, and those associations did remain constant when postoperative LSA and DSA values were utilized. The study is nice again that I said there's multiple surgeons, multiple sites, and it went through a society membership kind of aggregation of data. And I wish we had more of that, in all honesty. We get that through AJRR, but that's being collected only in certain centers. So to bring people together, to collect their data together, and to see outcomes is really nice. It just powers the study really nicely and gives you variation of practice throughout these areas there. It would be nice to see if there was a difference in fracture rates by implant type. So they didn't talk about which implants were used because likely multiple implants were used because multiple surgeons were involved. So I would like to know if there's any implication with that with regards to how the radiographs turned out the way they were. It is good for counseling. There are a bunch of patient factors associated with such as poor bone density and rotator cuff deficiency, which were the strongest predictors of these types of stress fractures. And it's also good for potentially guiding surgical technique with final implant positioning, It may affect the acromion and the scapular spine stress fractures, and an increased humeral lateralization was associated with lower fracture risk. So try to implement that in practice. Whereas excessive glenoid-sided and global lateralization were associated with higher fracture risk. So try to avoid those. So some practical tips and tricks. I will say that the sample size does help. I thought it was a decently well-done study, although retrospective.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the ability to include over 6,000 patients is quite advantageous. I think one important thing is not to have the stars in the eyes, so to speak, from the 6,000 patients, but to consider the fact that there are only 180 ASFs and 59 SSFs that were identified. So acromial stress fractures and scapular spine stress fractures, respectively. In a study that has a very large power, you can get a lot of general guidance is like those that have odds ratios of 2 or higher are probably going to be more, again, translatable and real. And there are several of those, inflammatory arthritis, rotator cuff tear, osteoporosis. Some of it fairly intuitive, I would think. The ones that have things under than that, the issue offset where it's an object 1.06, so 6% increase in odds. Age, ostensibly modeled as per year increase at 2%, that's not going to hold up very well if you imagine that like they're not adequately representing the spectrum of age across mutations with just 180 acromial stress fractures, for example. So the further you go out from sort of the population average, the less precise that's going to be. And obviously, when you're just talking about it, going to start overlapping the 95% confidence interval fairly quickly. So I think age is really hard to consider. So there are definitely a number of factors that can be considered in that regard by interested readers. We'll now move into the Your Cases on Hold featurette. This issue's Your Cases on Hold episode is patients with hip osteoarthritis have a higher rate of spinal reoperation following lumbar spinal fusion. This is by Mills and colleagues and does come with a commentary. This is work that was done using 5% Medicare claims data about the insidious hip spine syndrome, with which we are all very familiar. I think we've talked about hip spine syndrome in a number of different contexts over several of our more recent Your Cases on Hold episodes. Correct me if I'm wrong.
You're 100% right. It is a hot topic.
I think that this effort is getting into a little bit of the envelope pushing by trying to use Medicare claims data. We have talked in the past, not necessarily in this context, but in general, about a common trap where individuals try to use claims-based data to inform clinical practice. And that's incredibly hard to do because you do not have the granularity around what decisions were made and why. And I think that does come into play here. This study included over 1,100 patients who underwent spinal fusion and had hip osteoarthritis. Now, the first thing that I will take issue with is that the authors are using codes. And they're using codes to identify patients who underwent elective lumbar fusion from 2005 to 2019. And then they're looking at individuals who underwent elective hip replacement within 1 year after undergoing that spinal fusion. And then they say, individuals who had hip replacement, this indicates they had severe hip OA at the time of lumbar fusion. That's a little bit of a logical leap. Jump in on this. Happy to hear your thoughts, but not everyone who has a total hip arthroplasty has severe hip osteoarthritis. And what is severe hip osteoarthritis?
I completely agree.
There's not a code for severe hip osteoarthritis. Nope. You'll see radiology reports say severe hip osteoarthritis, and there's still a joint line, and they'll say there's moderate hip osteoarthritis, and it looks like it's like merged with the pelvis.
That's another fusion, but not in the right seat, not in a lumbar spinal one.
So I think that, you know, they're automatically jumping to this. Well, obviously, if they had hip replacement, they have severe hip arthritis. And I think there's a lot of variation in what the indications are or how bad arthritis has to be before a patient undergoes a hip replacement. And that varies based on the patient's symptoms, their desire to undergo a surgery, and the surgeon's desire as well. But in any case, they will at least say they have those who underwent hip arthroplasty and those who did not have a diagnosis of hip arthritis and also did not undergo hip arthroplasty. They do standard, you know, regression approaches, multivariable Cox regression, using age, sex, diabetes, heart disease, obesity, smoking status, osteoporosis, number of levels fused, use of posterior instrumentation, interbody device, bone graft, and surgical approach as covariates. The outcome of interest here is revision spine surgery within 3 years. I don't think these are all the factors that can actually address confounding around that. And they do it at 3 years and at 5 years. But they do find that patients with severe hip arthritis at the time of primary lumbar fusion had a significantly increased risk of spinal reoperation at 3 and 5 years postoperatively. I would reframe that as patients who underwent hip arthroplasty within 1 year of a primary lumbar fusion had a significantly increased risk of spinal reoperation at 3 and 5 years. They then say, and this is where they're really way out over their skis as far as I'm concerned, these data provide further evidence to support performing total hip prior to lumbar fusion. I think that's a problem because they don't have the counterfactual here. They're not contrasting adequately to different groups. Okay, they needed both. You had the hip done first or you had the lumbar spine done first. We're unclear on sort of the clinical or temporal trajectory that brought them from the hip replacement, or from the lumbar fusion rather, to the hip replacement. Patients who need multiple types of surgeries with like precocious osteoarthritis may be at increased risk of spine surgery failure, regardless of the timing of the surgical intervention. So I don't think there's evidence in this study to support the latter part of the conclusion. The first part of the conclusion is really just restating a fact. And I would, you know, caveat the fact that, you know, they don't actually know it's severe hip OA. They're using needing a hip replacement as a proxy for it. So if we just set that aside, I think that, yes, there's some signal there, but it's really, you're just not sure what the underlying driving motivations are for that. And I don't think it can be said from this study, certainly, that changing the clinical practice would invariably alter the outcome. I think what you get from this is that you say, if you're seeing somebody who has legitimate structural issues in both, they have to be aware. Because I think there are some studies that actually show you have the hip replacement first, then you get the lumbar fusion. That increases the risk that you might need a hip revision. Now, granted, these are not being done with Medicare. They may not have close to 10,000 patients or what have you. But there are some studies, at least in the spine literature that I've seen, that do speak to that. So it's, if you have the hip first and then the spine done later, you need a revision hip. If you have the spine done first and then have the hip done later, you need a revision spine. It's, you know, you're sort of damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, is the kind of thing. I think that so really the take-home message is that patients who have need for multiple major operations in the spinal pelvic region, I don't think anybody wants that. I think the take-home message is that these patients just have to understand that the ceiling for their outcomes and the risk of need for further surgery is decidedly different than if they just had one singular clinical issue. And that probably goes for like patients with hip and knee problems or knee and spine problems or knee and ankle problems. I don't think it's just unique to this clinical context.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, as someone who does hip replacement, it's just one of those things where we want a prescription, right? We want to be said, yes, we should do ours first, or we should wait till you do yours. And the same is true for foot and ankle and knees, right? There's always something that's adjacent to it. Then which one comes first, the chicken or the egg? And to determine causality from this is a big stretch. So the hard part is a lot of times people will just pick up the articles, and I'm definitely guilty of this too, and just read the conclusion. If you read this conclusion, that's exactly what it says. You know, you should do the hip first when you have severe hip OA at the time of primary lumbar fusion. So, you know, you should, that's a lot of clinical judgment based on not the greatest methodology.
Yeah. And if you're going to the boards and you did the hip first and they said, why'd you do the hip first? You could be like, well, the Mills article said that that's the way you should do it.
And that's what people would say. And then the patient gets, you know, repeat surgery or repeat, you know, hip revisions and things like that. Then what, right? So maybe in 5 years from now, we'll be looking at a different study and showing the opposite of Medicare data. So great.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it is Medicare data. So this is a population that is not necessarily translatable. It's not going to go for a patient who's 50 years old. I mean, if you look at some of the characteristics, this is 63%+ female, 91% white. The average age is 76.8. So forget about even just 50-year-olds. This may not even apply to a 65-year-old who is on Medicare.
Sure, definitely one thing to keep in mind for sure.
All right, we may be running a little bit short on time here. It certainly feels that way. But let's get into the honorable mentions at this point. So we have variation in the cost of hip arthroscopy for labral pathological conditions, a time-driven activity-based costing analysis. This is by Dean and colleagues, and actually comes from the Mass General Brigham system. We know these guys, as I like to say. They are using time-driven activity-based costing to characterize the cost composition of hip arthroscopy for labral pathological conditions and to identify factors that drive variation in costs. They identified wide patient-to-patient cost variation, similar to what has been seen in other arenas, most effectively explained by the method of labral management, the surgeon, osteoplasty, and the surgery center. So if you're interested in holding down, check out that article. Next, we have between standing long leg radiographs and CT scans in measuring coronal neoplasia. This is by Fontalis and colleagues. This is permanently free. This study was a multi-center cohort study across three tertiary centers, including 300 patients undergoing primary robotic arm-assisted total arthroplasty. They observed strong correlations between the long leg radiographs and CT scanograms that were made during preoperative planning, and implying that these can reliably be utilized, or that CT scanograms rather can be reliably utilized to estimate coronal alignment of the knee, potentially replacing the knee for the long leg radiographs. Last, we have defining the patient acceptable symptom state test for promised after total ankle replacement by Shaffrey. This has an infographic and also comes with a comment. This study was looking at the path for promise in total ankle arthroplasty. Single institutional study, including 127 primary total ankle patients at those with special surgery. The ability to reach the PASS was strongly associated with postoperative pain scores. The PASS thresholds were generally poorer than population means, which I think does have a very important implication for individuals undergoing these interventions. That about does it. I think we're out of time. We'll try to be better next time. If you like what you heard, please like and subscribe and join the tens of listeners in your Cases on Hold community. If you didn't like what you heard, give us a chance again. In 2 weeks, Dr. Chen will be leading the way. And she is overly critical of research in general. So you might get a more erudite, thoughtful, insightful, and critical commentaries from Dr. Chen. Thanks for sticking with us. Like and subscribe. Hit the notification bell. Check out our back issues. And we look forward to seeing you next time. In all seriousness.